The following interview was conducted on behalf of the oral history program of the Washington County Museum and Century High School. The interviewee is Jack Kirkwood. The interviewer is Kevin Johnson and Andrew Spearing. The interview took place at Century High School on Wednesday, May 23rd at 3:18 p.m. So, Mr. Kirkwood, could we get your name, your occupation, your age, and residence during the period of the Vietnam War?
During the period of the Vietnam War, I was a young man. I was teaching at Pointer Junior High and at Hillsboro Mid High.
Okay, now I'm going to open the questions up a little bit more. Is there anything that you can remember about Hillsboro during the period of the Vietnam War?
Well, it was a much smaller place than it is today. many of the roads that are five-lane arterials today were two-lane roads. And it's just been exploding in the last few years. Our own home at the time, we lived on Baseline Road between Beaverton and Hillsboro, and that area is exploding into housing
right
now too.
Right.
In fact, our own place that we farmed for quite a few years has now been developed into housing.
Wow, I lived there and now it's gone.
So, you actually farmed for a little while?
Yes, I did some farming for, I was doing some farming at the time that I was teaching. We had, in the beginning, we had about 17 acres, and then eventually we sold some off eventually, in 1972, I decided to give up teaching and scratch a living off the farm, and reduce our tax liability for one thing, and our family, our first child was born in 1972, and that was actually during the time the war was still going on,
right,
albeit toward the end of the war.
Right.
But at that time, we were hopeful that it would come to an end, but we were not sure of that. But anyway, it was difficult being a teacher and being an activist against the war. Sometimes if I would participate in a demonstration or make a speech that was on television or radio, people would call in to the superintendent and say, "What is that, some kind of commie you've got on your staff there?" and stuff like that. So I'd have to go in and defend my position. I was quite happy to do so. I had looked into the background of the war, and I really ought to go into a little bit of my background that before the war, caused me to have
That's what actually one of the questions was. What was the cause of your so activities in the war?
This didn't just come out of the blue.
I'm sure it didn't.
I finished college at Lewis and Clark College in 1950, and I spent 2 years on the Navajo Indian Reservation teaching in a school most of them were Indians, and this was most of them were Navajo and some Hopi and a scattering of others. It was a boarding school at Ganado, Arizona, under the auspices of the Presbyterian National Board of Missions. So that was my first job, and I had that was about the time the Korean War was starting, and so I got a deferral from that. But the more I you know, I decided I wanted to discharge my obligation under the draft, and I had not studied the Korean situation thoroughly, and I was not objecting to what the government was trying to do in that situation. Maybe I would have been if I knew a little more about it. But having been on the Navajo Indian Reservation and not receiving a lot of input from the press and everything, I really didn't know a great deal of what was going on in those days. Anyway, I decided to enlist in the Army, and perhaps I applied for officer's candidate school. I thought maybe I could do that and do my duty to the country.
Right.
So I went to basic training at Camp San Luis Obispo in California, and stayed there as cadre, waiting for a call to officers training school. And after about a year of that kind of work, they decided that they weren't going to, the war was winding down, the Korean War was winding down, and they weren't going to need officers, so they decided to ship me to Japan, to the Camp Drake Replacement Depot, and from there they would make assignments to various places in Asia, including Korea. I was there for a while before I was reassigned to a Signal Corps group. They decided I was misassigned. I was in an adjutant message center, and I went to a Signal Corps message center, which was at Pershing Heights, which at that time was the United Nations Far East Command headquarters in Tokyo. Now the war was in Korea was over by that time. The armistice had been signed, but there was still activity, as there is today.
Right.
There, we still have troops in Korea today. What I was doing, I was working a night shift, and we were monitoring propaganda broadcasts coming from China.
Wow.
And those, none of those were encrypted. Most of the messages we got that went to headquarters were encrypted, and we couldn't read the stuff. We just sent it to the encryption department, that was it. But these were all in English, you know, these propaganda. And so we had a general idea of what the people of China were hearing from their, this was after the Chinese Communist Revolution, which occurred in, was it 1949, I believe, 48 or 49.
Right.
And so they were trying to convince their people that they were making progress, and they were doing a lot of things for improving the living conditions of people, improving education, improving medical care, and all of this came through in the propaganda. Then there was the same attitude we've often had in Congress. There were three senators who were trying to convince the country that we ought to back Chiang Kai-shek, who had escaped to Taiwan, and that was his place of operation. And these three senators, including one of them was Senator Noland of California, I remember that, I don't remember the other two, but they wanted the United States to give air cover to Chiang Kai-shek to return to the mainland and take over Communist China. You know, this would be rolling back communism. But after having been reading what the Chinese communists were telling their people for so long, I had very little thought that any such operation could have any success at all, and it would be a tremendous disaster. So I kind of lost my faith in the government's ability. And of course, we didn't do that. The government didn't follow their suggestion. But the government has not been really terribly honest about the things they've been doing from time to time, and that's true about Vietnam. Now, Vietnam was not something, you know, when it hit the news in the United States, a lot of people wondered, where was it? They didn't remember studying it or anything. Well, when I was in Japan, I had gone on a trip to Southeast Asia. I wanted to visit the Philippines and Vietnam and Thailand. Those were the three places. My friend and I had decided to go, and we knew we had another friend who spent some time in Thailand visiting his missionary parents, and so we kind of consulted with him to find out how he was able to do this, and we were able to do it too. And we were not given permission to visit Vietnam. That was 1955, and that's the Geneva Accords were 1954.
Right.
And there was supposed to be free travel across the border between North and South, and that was to be a temporary military demarcation line. It was not designed as a national boundary.
Right.
Right.
Anyway, we were not permitted to visit Saigon because of the fact that there were so many refugees from the South, and the hotels were full, and there was danger at that time. There was concertina wire around, and we were able to wander around the airport there, but beyond that, all we saw of Vietnam was the rice paddies is taking off on the aircraft, you know, we could see the people, and a very common scene in Southeast Asia. But anyway, in Thailand, we had a very nice visit. We were most of the time in Bangkok, but we went north some, and we took a train trip to the north to see some of the ancient ruins. And so, you know, I have a little familiarity there. We
right.
spent a little time in the Philippines too, only a couple of days in the Philippines, but we were able to travel around Manila and see some of the destruction from the war, because that was still, you know, not too far from World
yeah.
War II, about 10 years after. And anyway, that is my background of experience.
Right. So you actually were over in that area during that time. Wow.
Then when I came back to the United States, I should say first, there were these reenlistment appeals that came as my enlistment expired and I was going to be processed for return to the United States. I, because of this thing with Senator Noland and the proposals
right.
for what we should do, I thought, well, you know, if that should actually happen, I wouldn't be in service. I would be a conscientious objector on any kind of
project. It doesn't
project
even seem
of that
reasonable.
Kind. No, it doesn't. I could not. Of course, it never happened, and that's. But I must say that I was a little leery of, you know, I was, whenever the government would get involved in something, I would take a second look. And that was true when I was teaching social studies in English at Pointer Junior High, and we would discuss it news events. And it was part of the news.
Right.
We were watching the war on our televisions.
Well,
and so I've
right.
looked into some of the background of the war, how we got into it, what our role in the Geneva Accords ending the war between the French and so on. And I knew I had to make a statement against it.
Right.
And I wrote a letter to the Oregonian, which was published, and I got a call from somebody who was on the staff at the Portland Council of Churches. They were working on this project. He'd gone to Washington, D.C. to try to stop the war and things like that, and they wanted me to join clergy and laity concerned and about Vietnam. And so I did that, and I served I was the chairman of the group for a while, for several years, and that's how I got involved in certain coalition activities,
right.
Speaking and demonstrations and debating people on the opposite side of the issue and things like that,
yeah.
That went on from time to time. And that's how I got called into the office.
Wow. You had made a comment about teaching it in social studies about news offense. What were their reactions to it? Did they really understand when you were teaching it to them, or was it just kind of like you more understood it than they did? And
well, let me say this. I didn't try to use the classroom as a platform for my opinions about the war.
Right.
I didn't try to propagandize the students against the war. I didn't think that was my role. What I tried to do was to encourage them to read what was happening and read it in a critical way and to ask questions happening and things like that. So it was that part was not difficult for me. I was professionally committed to
right.
that position.
Right.
And so I really didn't ever get into trouble with the administration for what I was doing in the classroom.
Right.
I did, and I wouldn't say I got into the trouble with the administration for my writing letters to the editor or my speaking at different events. They understood that as my right as an American citizen
right.
to do. And this is part of what our military are supposed to be defending,
right,
is
right.
our rights
say.
to be able to speak out on issues of concern to us.
Also, and after you had left your teaching, do you feel that Vietnam affected your decision in leaving to, you know, go off and do the farm thing? I mean, do you feel that, you know, maybe that was a big, you know, dent in there, that was a reason why that you possibly left teaching?
Well, it certainly did have
an effect.
Partly, I left in 1972, and I must say that it's hard to explain in simple terms when you make a decision like that.
Right.
Our first child had been born, and my wife was a professional person too. She was a teacher as well, and doing. She has been substituting even during these times, but she needed help in looking after the children and so on. And we could simply change our operation a little bit. We started boarding some horses and raising some cattle and doing some things like that on the farm. And eventually I was making hay on neighboring fields around. And a lot of this was subsistence type stuff. We weren't really able to make it on just that income.
I'm
eventually
sure.
I took an Oregonian route. An automobile route with about 400 daily Sunday customers. So anyway, we got along okay.
Now you've been taught.
I was still an activist during that time. I made a trip to Washington, D.C., a national conference of clergy and laity concern, and one to Cincinnati, Ohio for a meeting. And then I continued to work because there were lots of issues that were not solved by the ending of the war.
Right. Yeah.
The war was a symptom of what was going wrong in the country. That's the problem of misappropriation of funds and bad analysis of. Bad intelligence, should I say. If we look back on the history, nearly every one of these difficulties that we've been in has resulted from mistakes on the part of the CIA and other government officials. And a lot of this is affected by politics, too.
Right, right.
And even today, you know, we're right now, we are in a very difficult time in the United States. A serious choice is trying to be influenced. There are two sides to the issue. It's not entirely partisan, partly partisan, but part of the country is wanting to emphasize American sovereignty over American participation in the world community. We do things based on our own sovereign decisions, and we don't join treaties where our people become subject to the judgments of international bodies or something like this. So we find one after another. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was not approved by the Senate of the United States. The International Criminal Court, which was supposed to be a way to process war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. We were very much in the process of helping to set that up, and it is a very good document in the sense that it honors the due process,
right,
that we have in American court system. Mm-hmm. They won't have juries as we have in our country, but it is not unconstitutional for us to participate in some kind of, and all those things were covered by legal counsel that was there at Rome in that debate. There are those in this country who would like to move the country in the direction of an interdependent world with eventually some type of world governance in which the solution, the problems that can't be solved by any one nation alone would be handled by an international body. Now, of course, we have the United Nations. It doesn't have that authority at this time. It doesn't have any military forces, but right now we're attempting to give the United Nations some, there is a group at least, quite a few in the world, and a lot of people in the United States that would like to give the United Nations, the Security Council in particular, command of a brigade, approximately 5,000 to 6,000 people, that could be signed to crisis situations like occurred in Rwanda in 1994. There was a peacekeeping operation there at the time, but it wasn't, we had just gotten out of Somalia, and President Clinton was not willing to give the go-ahead and the logistical support to that kind of an operation to stop that. It probably could have been done very easily, although the force was only 2,500, maybe with a little. It would have taken a few more probably, but most of that was done with machetes, you know. It wasn't a real modern kind of thing. But there were 800,000 people killed in that. And then it cost us more than $2 billion in humanitarian aid to clean up the mess that was created by that. And yet if that brigade could have been sent down there to stop that, under the authority of the Security Council, so that they wouldn't have to get approval from national governments who have all these political problems to deal with, it might have worked out
right,
much better.
Right.
So anyway,
I
haven't gone too far afield in here.
you've been talking about some of the different activities you did to protest the war. What exactly were the activities? I mean, you talked about some, you know, kind of what were all of them that you did?
Well, it's hard to remember precisely just what.
Did you find them effective? Did they seem to jar any minds or boggle any people?
I found both the Argus and the Oregonian, which were the two papers that I would write to.
Right.
Both of them were mostly in disagreement with my position.
I think we found that out in the Arguses that we have over there. Uh-huh. And it was like, yeah.
And of course, that's still going on. I have a letter right here that I wrote a week or so ago to the Argus in response to an editorial on national missile defense. Highly supportive of it, and yet I have studied it carefully, and I have come to the exact opposite position that they have. They haven't published my letter yet, and I don't know if they will, but I think they might.
This man's my new hero. He's against the missile defense. Oh yeah.
Did anyone oppose and if so, who the activities that you were doing?
There were people who there was one person who was quite upset about the fact that the Oregonian published a number of my letters to the editor and not theirs. theirs were opposite mine, and the Oregonian didn't agree with theirs either. But anyway, I was pleased that I had as many of them published as I did. I also sent letters to Congress. I was very pleased with both Wayne Morrison, who was senator, and Senator Hatfield, who were both strongly opposed to war activities.
Right.
Other things that I did, I participated in demonstration marches in downtown, and helped to organize them, and we always had, in those days, we always had good relations with the police. We get our parade permits, and there's usually a motorcycle cop along with us, but they were friendly, you know. You didn't know whether the motorcycle policeman was opposed to what you were doing or very much in support of it. He was just doing what he had to
right.
do. Then we had meetings in churches sometimes that would gather together some of the people on both sides of issues, and then we'd debate them, and I participated in some of those debates, and
all of these things took place locally here.
Well, a lot of this was in Portland area,
right.
You know, rather than Hillsboro. Not so much right here in Hillsboro, but we would have a monthly meeting of clergy and laity concerned, and we work on the planning of some of those things. And we did have an executive director who was a paid staff, and there were people who would contribute to the group to pay the salary and so on. I never received anything
that. Do you remember any thing specifically that happened in Hillsboro, like demonstration-wise, any anti-war protests?
I don't remember in Hillsboro war protests, but there were a number of them in Portland. Some on the Portland State campus that I can recall. I wasn't there for those, and some of those got a little nasty. But all those that I participated in
were pretty peaceful.
They were peaceful demonstrations, and that's that was. Those were during the days of Martin Luther King,
right?
And he was one who we looked to for leadership in how you deal with these things, and he was an advocate of the nonviolent position.
Yes, he was.
And then there are other organizations, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which dates from World War I, which we worked with, and eventually when clergy and laity dissolved, some of its activities were taken over by Fellowship of Reconciliation. So.
Lots of involvement. Mm-hmm. Since you've, you know, written and done these things, have your opinions changed, or have they always stayed the same, you know, being anti-war, now knowing some of the information that, you know, you didn't possibly know then? Have your, you know, thoughts or views changed on maybe you would go back and change some of the things that you said or did?
Well, I appreciate that question. When I got the call yesterday about the interview, I dug out this old pamphlet that I had written years ago. Actually, that A Citizen's View of the Vietnam War, which I wrote in 1967, was partly to defend my professional position as teacher in the schools, because I thought I should be able to put something in the hands of the superintendent and the school board and the principal or any of the teachers that might question what I was doing, to understand the background of my thinking and why I had come to the positions that I had come to. This is, it says, a moral, philosophical, and practical reasons why one man opposes the Vietnam War. And I didn't find very much. I think there are some of the things that I afterwards, after I wrote the essay, that you know, my knowledge is perhaps a little more complete now than it was at that time. But it's basically the same. There is a very good film. In fact, I had the film and used to use it, and I gave it to the Washington County Film Library. And apparently, there weren't enough calls for it, and it's disappeared. I mean, they've discarded it or something. But
we don't even want to go into Washington County's ability to keep knowledge.
David Shinbrun was addressing a meeting of businessmen who had mobilized against the Vietnam War. And he was giving his opinions. Of course, he was a journalist, and he'd had considerable background dating into World War II days. And I have the soundtrack of that.
Ooh.
And I could provide that for you.
That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful.
Now, did you show any of your students this movie or anything?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And now, how did they react to the anti-war type stuff?
I didn't use it as a regular, if it fit in to a unit that we were doing, I would use it. And we would use it for discussion purposes and try to understand the opinions. This is one of the things I tried to help the students understand, the opinions of those who opposed the war. I thought they should know those things, because there was much anti-war activity, and that was on the news too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed to know, they needed to have that background.
Right.
And so, but we'd always try to balance that with things on the other side as well. So it wasn't that we were trying to push this point of view, but I wasn't trying to hide it either.
Right.
So.
Now, were most of your students, would you say, pro-war or anti-war?
We never did take a vote. I didn't, I don't, most of them I would have to say were non-committal. Some were obviously anti-war. These were junior high age students,
right.
So they hadn't matured as much as high school students would, and would not have developed in their thinking perhaps as much. But I think they were good in accepting the various you know, they would participate in presenting news that they would clip from the newspapers and things like that, and sometimes it was news of anti-war activity, and so...
they kept an open mind
I think
about
so.
The war?
I think so. And if they didn't, they didn't tell me. I realized that some of them may not have, because they knew where I stood on this
right,
issue.
Yeah.
They may not have wanted to, and I was sensitive to that possible feeling too.
Right.
But anyway, that's kind of...
So is there anything that we didn't ask you, or that you would like to recall to us or mention right now?
Well, one thing that I didn't mention, I don't think it's in this pamphlet, but the Vietnam War, and you may know this already, but the Geneva Accords of 1954 that was the treaty that ended the war between the French and
right.
the Vietnamese.
Yeah.
And we had people attending that treaty discussion. And we were not signatories to the treaty, but we did sign protocol agreements that we would not upset the treaty by force. And then we proceeded to do that. So that's one objection that
right,
I had
right.
Against the war, and I didn't really include that point in here.
Well, I guess one final question that I'd like to say, since we're using the Argus as a sense of reference, I think the article that we had read was The Price of Peace, I think, was the name of some article in there that you had written.
I did have a series of articles.
Right. And,
under the title Price of Peace, I think you're right,
right.
That was the
And there was a response to your article by Rob and Katie.
Mm-hmm.
And we just want to know your take on, you know, where he was coming from, and it was, you know, how did you feel on his response to that article? And I think he wrote it in, I think it was February of 72, they printed that out in the Argus, that he had, I think it was like the Vietnam Perspective, I think was mm-hmm. the name of the article. Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't really remember that response to it. There was some response occasionally to these
right.
special articles. Yeah, I in addition to letters to the editor, I did that series one time because
right.
You know, they don't like to print letters to the editor constantly
right.
from one person. They try to pass that around the community, and I felt that it at that time particularly there was a need for something coming out regularly. I forget how often that came out.
You remember seeing it twice, one in 72 maybe, and I think that February issue.
Maybe
then
every couple months or so.
Right.
I don't remember just how often it was. I should have all these things cataloged and
right.
But I am afraid that I haven't spent enough time organizing my past. I haven't thrown away a lot of stuff, and there's a lot of stuff to go through, so...
Yeah, I'm sure.
Eventually we'll probably get to that.
Sure. I'm sure. Well, we want to thank you for taking this interview. It's really been a help, and I think we found out a lot of information that I think we were clueless about, even being, you know, in an advanced placement class. There were a lot of little things that I think that we didn't know, and we had a very hard time finding any information locally
mm-hmm.
about it. And I think that really you did help us with the information that you did have, you know, some of the, you know, the personal views and stuff. So I want to thank you for coming here on this
well,
interview.
You're quite welcome.